Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, our roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, the X-Men are back after a couple of years away, so we'll look in on the mutants. And because we love evil as much as you do, we'll pull back and talk a little about the power of supervillains. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week, so stick around.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Try out the NPR One app for your phone for conversations you won't hear anywhere else. This week, find Guy Raz's exclusive interview with TED curator Chris Anderson, where they discuss the TED phenomenon and the secrets to giving a great TED Talk. Find their conversation by searching TED Radio on the NPR One app, where you can also find stories from your local station, as well as more great podcasts. NPR One is in your app store now.
We've got mutants and villains on this week's show, but not on the panel, fortunately. So before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Chris Klimek, we have had you on the show before, but remind people what it is you do.
I try to sound glib and glabrous when Glenn Weldon is not here.
That's right.
Overinvest in superhero movies.
Yeah, Glenn's got the week off. But fortunately, that means that Chris is here. And also with us, you have heard previously, if you listened to the show, you heard his interview with Leslie Odom Jr. from Hamilton in one of our episodes. Daud Tyler Amin. Hey, bud.
Hi there.
What do you do?
I'm an editor and writer with NPR Music, but the last time I was on this show, I introduced myself and Stephen tried to fight me.
That's right.
So maybe we can change it to, like, comptroller.
You
like
can just... I'll
systems analyst. One of those ones that nobody checks.
I'm sitting between Stephen and Daud right now, so it's going to be fun.
It's you know, we sit pretty close together, but the tension is always thick.
That's right. The tension is always palpable. So we did want to start this week talking about X-Men. Now, some of you, specifically X-Men Apocalypse, so some of you are going to hear this and think to yourselves, this is a lot of superhero movies. I just want to remind you, we actually skipped Deadpool.
Yeah.
And relevant to this franchise, we actually skipped Days of Future Past, which I didn't even see. And I don't think Steven did either. But
wow. You,
Chris, did,
okay.
And Daud did.
We're going to have to talk about
yep.
that.
We have adequate knowledge on
the panel.
It's
like the whole title crawl for this movie.
Just settle down, Chris Klimek. The way that this is set up, Oscar Isaac, who you would not know was himself necessarily if you didn't know it was him in this movie.
People have pointed out his resemblance to Ivan Ooze from the Power Rangers.
Plays a blue fellow, a blue man, but not one of the
blue god.
Blue man group. A blue
have
god.
Some respect.
A blue god who is in Egypt because he's in Egypt, and
yes.
they kind of, he's risen from a something, and now he's a world battling god mutant thing.
Yeah, so I think the second time I saw this, I understood what was happening in the prologue a little bit more, where I think he is transferring his consciousness into another mutant who has some kind of regenerative immortality power so that he can live on forever. It's the only time you see Oscar Isaac look like Oscar Isaac.
Right, exactly. So as we find them, Magneto is off living like in secret with a wife and child. Professor Xavier is welcoming Cyclops to school. Quicksilver is kind of on the way. And when Mystique learns that Magneto has been busted and he's now a wanted man, she starts trying to get the gang back together to find him, not realizing he's already hooked up with a big blue Oscar Isaac. Chris, you reviewed this movie for NPR.org. What did you think?
Mixed. And then I saw it again and went a little more mixed positive. You know, what I remember about picking up my first issue of the X-Men comic is that it is Byzantine. It is impenetrable.
Yeah.
Like, you are entering in media res all the time. And, you know, six movies in, this film franchise has abandoned any pretense of accessibility.
Right.
You know, you're either with it or you're not.
Right.
I think the beginning and ending of this are, you know, kind of CGI overload. You lose the stakes. I think the middle 80 minutes are pretty good. Very soap operatic, the way that the X-Men comics traditionally have been.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm, you know, mixed positive. It's one of the lesser films in the franchise, but... certainly enjoyed it well enough.
As our other closer to expert than me or Thompson, Daud, how did you like this movie?
The very fact that you disclaimed the fact that we were talking about a superhero movie before we even started, like, that's telling, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a climate around this right now. There's a great essay by Wesley Morris in the New York Times, I want to say like 2 months ago, called Deadpool Isn't the Only Solution, But Batman Versus Superman Is the Problem. And his point was basically that, like, there's such a glut of superhero movies, and especially such a glut of really serious superhero movies, that the ones that achieve some kind of lightness of tone, mm-hmm. and also a certain amount of self-awareness are are the ones that really stand out. So this was a couple of months ago, and he was talking about Deadpool Ant-Man, Guardians of the Galaxy. Uh-huh. So that's the universe that this movie is entering into. And I do kind of like that they go for lightness occasionally. Mm-hmm. There are some good jokes in it.
Yeah.
Magneto swears, that's new. It got a laugh in the theater that I was in.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, this franchise has set for itself a pretty dastardly creative trap because you've got a couple of movies that people really like. X-Men 3 happens. And people say, I'm not so sure about this. They restart the entire timeline. Yeah. And then we get Days of Future Past, which is this sort of bifurcated story. And like Chris was saying, it sort of undoes some of the things that, you know, that we've already seen happen. And so when we enter into this, we're already sort of in a tangent universe. And the stakes have already kind of been undermined. Mm-hmm. The way that these kinds of franchises work right now is it has that kind of like sickly infinite scroll feeling where it expands forever in either direction. Uh-huh. Nobody is ever really dead. No story is ever totally concluded. And I mean, in the same way that the story can feel kind of unanchored, like, yeah, a lot of the action felt sort of like unanchored in space and time and lacking in sort of physicality. The same way that like Audie Cornish was on the show a couple of weeks ago talking about romantic comedies, and she said they often have a problem where you're like, where is this happening? And action movies have some, it's sort of kind of the same thing. Like sometimes when you get into like excessive CGI, too many characters, too much to deal with, it can feel really overwhelming.
And there's nothing to grab onto.
That's right. So I didn't dislike it, but I went into it with adjusted expectations, as I think a lot of people probably did if they've been paying attention.
Yeah. How about you, Thompson? How'd it work for you?
I have not been paying attention. And so I stepped in to the third film in a trilogy that in many ways behaves as if it's the first film in a trilogy. It feels like it's reintroducing 25 different characters and then piling on this huge, cumbersome story about the, you know, Egyptian blue god man who's mad. It's kind of Ultron-y.
Right.
Kind of.
Very Ultron.
Very, very Ultron-y.
With
presence.
Sort of a chopped and screwed voice, though.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's so much story. It feels like 5 or 6 movies in a way. There are individual scenes and set pieces that I think are really effective. I think there's a really nice scene with Quicksilver in general, I think, is the most enjoyable component of this movie for me.
Right.
There's a terrific scene in which his powers are exhibited.
And you and I didn't know this, but Daoud explained this
to me.
That
is a straight-up retread.
A
better version of that scene in a prior movie.
Exactly, yeah.
I did read this, that it is apparently a total rehash as a newbie.
Yeah.
I saw the original OG X-Men movies from 2000
was
the
first one.
Well, you saw First Class because we talked about it on the show.
I have no memory of that.
Yeah. You saw First Class.
It's a shame. It's a good movie.
Yeah, that's one of the better ones.
What did I think of it?
I think you liked it. The thing that's interesting to me about this, the thing that is interesting about the Oscar Isaac character, the big bad, is that he's very serious, plays it very straight, but he talks like the Eddie Redmayne character in Jupiter Ascending. In terms of what he says.
Very consoling.
But in terms of what he says, like the thing that made the Eddie Redmayne character in Jupiter Ascending work, and yes, I said work, was he's so silly.
Yeah.
It's such a kind of campy, I know campy is kind of an overused word, but it's kind of a gleefully goofy, over-the-top villainous performance where I think what I said at the time is it's like when a kid plays with 2 action figures, it's the voice and the style that he would give the bad guy. Mm-hmm. He's like, I will crush you.
While sort of inexplicably weeping.
Exactly. So he doesn't really say anything of consequence, but because it's so stylish, it kind of gets over.
My girlfriend saw this movie and she said, I love Oscar Isaac, but every line they gave him to say made him sound like a low-rent Soul Cycle instructor.
That nails it. I mean, this is the least allegorical X-Men film that this has been. You know, in prior installments in the comics, you know, the state of being a mutant was a sort of an easy to read metaphor for any kind of otherness. And the earlier films leaned on that more. There is a scene in X2 where a character comes out to his parents as a mutant, and it's very moving. It's not overplayed. And I mean, this movie kind of loses all of that, which is weird because this is from Bryan Singer. It is the fourth one he's made. He's the guy who made the first 2 very well-regarded X-Men movies and Days of Future Past, which was...
And The Usual Suspects.
More in the middle.
Right, yeah. I mean, that's what got him the job. He showed that he could, you know, manage a story with a large number of characters and still preserve some sense of surprise in it. But yeah, it's kind of like we've had sort of a soft reboot, mm-hmm. but by the original guy.
Yeah.
You know, you haven't brought in a new creative team to clean house. So it's really strange.
And I don't want to say so much the politics are lost in this version, but it's not just the politics, it's the philosophy, right? Mm-hmm. And my whole thing with superhero movies has increasingly been I want them to have an idea. It doesn't mean that it has to be high-minded, but I prefer for them to be about something. And I think what's interesting about comparing Civil War, for example, with Batman v Superman is those movies start with kind of the same idea, which is superheroes reckoning with the damage that they do.
Right.
Now, I would argue Civil War carries through on that promise a lot more than the Batman movie does. This movie is it's entirely contained inside its own four corners. Mm-hmm. And I think what you're saying about the mutants and the othering is partly that there's always been that idea that there was a bigger thought behind the whole idea of the X-Men, the idea of what they were a metaphor for. And that does seem to have kind of been abandoned in that, like, they don't really touch the kind of separatist versus,
right.
you know.
Right, which is, I mean, that's the first scene of the first movie where you have Ian McKellen and Captain Picard.
Yeah,
Patrick Stewart. Staring
You're
each
fired.
Other across this home. I never saw Star Trek. I don't know what that is.
You're so fired.
Magneto has become really the driving character of this mm-hmm. franchise, and I think that's very interesting. And you know, the new cast,
right.
Fassbender and McAvoy, they really commit to this. They are unembarrassable. Like, they can kind of do anything, which covers up some of the failures of the writing sometimes.
Yeah, I'm sorry, David. I think you were going to say something about the metaphor business.
Well, I mean, there's a couple of things going on here, right? I mean, I don't think I've ever seen a big screen, big budget comic book movie where people talk more like people in an actual comic book. And so you
get... Interesting. Meaning what?
Meaning that you get people saying things like, to cause some sort of apocalypse.
Yeah.
Like, it's
you
like...
You can see the dot, dot, dot.
Yeah. Like, it's like... it's very on the nose. It's like...
Dot, 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 and then the bold type, right?
It's like Paul Rudd in Walk Hard when he's playing John Lennon, and he's like, with meditation, there's no limit to what we can imagine. Like, it's that moment, but for real.
It's very Paul Harvey, if that reference makes any sense to anyone listening to this show.
Yeah.
I don't know. The other thing that I've been thinking about, though, and it's, I mean, you mentioned Civil War, and Civil War is, like, at its heart, it's really all about relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And so you think about a story where, like, you've got an unstable combination of people. They're sort of bound together by circumstance. And without that circumstance, like, not all of them would be friends, probably. Everybody wants something a little bit different. Everybody has, you know, a little bit of something to hide. And the revelation of those secrets coming out over time really kind of changes the atmosphere in the room. That's something you could say about Civil War.
Yeah.
It's something you could say, I think, about the first two X-Men movies. And that actually leads me straight back to The Usual Suspects. What makes that movie work? You know, not a perfect movie. I think, like, looking back at it now, like, the way that Kevin Spacey talks in that movie feels a lot sillier than maybe it did at the time. But it's all about the development and creation of alliances and the way that those alliances shift and taking these different people who all have different reasons for being there and giving them a circumstance where they are stuck together and something is going to combust.
Yeah.
That's what you have in the first two X-Men movies. And as you go forward in a series like this, you start to add other characters from that universe.
Yeah.
And that can be really exciting if you're a fan, because you can look in the trailers and you can say, there's Beast, there's Psylocke. But it can also have a really wearying effect, because the essential chemistry of the characters that you've introduced at the beginning sort of starts to break down. And in the X-Men universe, you can go on forever.
Yeah.
Like, that's the difference between something like this and, like, the Avengers or, like, the Justice League, where it's like there's at least a finitude to that.
Yeah.
And here it's like, if Glenn Weldon was here and I said, who's in the X-Men again? He'd be like, what year? Which writer? What are you even talking about?
Yeah. Well, and and the other thing, too, is it gets diluted by the fact that, I mean, the thing is 2.5 hours long, but there still is only so much that you can serve.
Mm-hmm.
And so once you've introduced all these people, you know, Stephen and I saw this with his daughter, who commented on the way home, essentially, they spent more time with the Oscar Isaac Blue Man giving makeovers to the kind of people he was recruiting than they really did having those people do anything,
right.
Which is part of what I think of when Steven says it acts like the first movie in a trilogy. There's a tremendous amount of setup of him kind of, you know, I transfer the angel into the angel with the knife wings, and it's and it's cool.
And then they do almost nothing.
But they
with
don't.
Those
they don't do a lot with that. And the Olivia Munn Psylocke is the same way. Yeah. It's like, why is she even there?
And as I pointed out, I leaned over to Linda and actually whispered, like, I don't think she's dressed appropriately for Auschwitz. She's wearing like a one piece.
There is an Auschwitz sequence, and she is dressed strangely.
It does, and it's worth bringing up. Like, there are several nagging, like, superhero movie tropes that this thing hits really, really hard. And as much as we often will come back and wail on them, it's worth pointing out yet again that this is another superhero movie, first of all, that, yes, has somebody in a one piece at Auschwitz, but also has maybe the highest body count of an action movie I've ever seen.
This, I mean, Man of Steel pales against really how many pales. People I mean, die this in the third act of this thing. And then Magneto is entirely let off the hook for that. He has a jovial conversation with Professor X.
Yeah. Oh, my God. And speaking of Magneto, speaking of tropes that this movie really, really busts out, is the female characters who are brought into this movie solely to have their deaths make a man feel sad.
Yeah.
Which is really frustrating and really hard to watch in 2016.
Yeah. There is a really nice piece that Tasha Robinson and one of her colleagues at The Verge did today where they talked about a couple of these things, including this. She talked about the phenomenon of as soon as you see, in certain situations, you see someone who has a family, a wife and child.
Yeah.
And you say, oh, well, they're...
That's gonna be the impetus
for tragedy.
I gotta say that scene. I thought in isolation it was really good.
Yeah,
I thought it was played well. I mean,
I
remember the audience, the critic audience that I saw this with, really responding, you know, vocally to that scene. And like, I mean, they weren't hooting; like, they gasped.
Yeah.
Gasped like, oh no.
Well, yeah, it's terrible, yeah. Like, but it's
It's staged well.
Well, it's Michael Fassbender. It's
right.
Yeah.
There's a lot of skill in that scene.
Right.
It is just an irritating cliche.
Yeah.
It is.
Movies that I am tired of.
Well, this is a movie that I think we all had sort of mixed reactions to in different ways, and I will be curious to hear what all of you thought of the movie. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH, or you can tweet us at PCHH and tell us what you thought of this lovely movie. Now, we have spent a lot of time talking about the perceived inadequacies, please don't come after me, Large Blue God Man, of the Large Blue God Man in this movie as a supervillain. When we come back, we're going to talk about supervillains in general, really big bad guys, what makes them work, what makes them not work. So come right back.
Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour and the following message comes from Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo understands that you work hard to get the most out of life. From starting a business to saving for retirement, there are a lot of things you want to accomplish. Working together, Wells Fargo will take the time to understand what you're trying to achieve to help you reach your financial goals. That way you can care for the people and things that matter most. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/together. Wells Fargo. Together we'll go far.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Before the break, we were talking about X-Men Apocalypse, and now we're going to talk about supervillains. So, you know, we're in that kind of mood. Part of the way that we got talking about this topic is that Daoud had a Twitter conversation going a couple months ago?
Something like that.
In which you asked essentially what question? What was the question that you started with?
The question was something that I guess had been bothering me recently, which was, can you think of a modern superhero movie, and modern is, I guess, relative to everybody's own life.
Sure, yes.
I thought about modern as starting with, say, the Sam Raimi Spider-Man
series. That's very reasonable.
2002.
Sure. Very something reasonable like that. Definition.
Can you name a modern superhero movie in which the villain's plan makes any kind of logical sense?
Yes.
And I started out saying, like, the one thing that I can maybe confidently submit is Christopher Nolan's Joker. Not necessarily because that character has follow-up, but just because I buy the idea of a sort of self-appointed agent of chaos.
It like, makes sense to him.
That's right.
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 You know, the further you start to get into some of those movies, like, I thought about, you know, the best-loved Marvel Cinematic Universe movies, and you've got Loki, who's a pretty good villain, but the thing that's fun about Loki is that he's pretty short-sighted, too.
Yeah.
Like, he struck me, I think the way I phrased it was that, like, he seems like this petulant kid in a plastic crown who just happened to get his hands on some real firepower. Like,
yeah.
You don't actually know what he plans to do once he rules the world. It's
right.
The exercise of power is the whole point.
Right.
And so going forward, I mean, people jumped in. The thing that actually interested me the most was people pointed out, like, cycles of abuse and the way that that manifests in these stories, both with the Joker, who has, you know, his line in The Dark Knight where he says, "My father was a drinker." Mm-hmm. It's one of many origin stories that he offers for the scars on his face. There's also Lex Luthor in Batman versus Superman hints at some kind of paternal abuse. And that sort of becoming like an existential grudge against God, which explains, I guess, why he has such a problem with Superman.
But again, those are motives, right? I think the part of what you were asking was like what they're actually trying to do. And I had, this is where like your the sort of funny stuff around your definition of modern came up, because I didn't notice that you said modern. So I had mentioned Lex Luthor, played by Gene Hackman in the Richard Donner Superman.
From 1978.
It is not modern. I did not think it was modern. I just didn't read the question. I just wasn't paying attention. So because in that Superman movie, you know, the beginning is kind of grand, giant world, Marlon Brando, Krypton, all this stuff. By the time you get into the actual movie, they're talking about a relatively compact plot, which is essentially Lex Luthor wants to destroy California so that a bunch of land that he owns will now be...
Right.
You know,
he just wants to get rich.
It's
not
just
the
real
murder,
estate.
The genocide is not the goal. He's willing to do it to rise to inflate his property.
It's a means, not an end.
But it's a real estate scheme, which inside this movie, you're like, sure, if you owned a bunch of land and if you like chopped off California and dropped it into the ocean, all of a sudden you would have coastal land instead of unsalable desert. And that plan, as it stands, makes some sense.
And that plan is kind of already in motion by the time we meet that character. That's the other thing. I think the thing that we run into a lot of the time is just that, like, superhero movies tend to be tasked with a lot. You need a villain's origin story, the hero's origin story. You got to build the world. You got to, you know,
set the stakes.
Yeah, create, like, an escalating conflict. A lot of times you have a sort of final boss battle and you have an epilogue that teases the sequel. It's a lot to do in 2 hours. And it's like,
It's why it takes 2.5 now.
And what you're adapting is comic books, which are by their very nature serialized, and they're full of editorial notes to previous issues, and they end in cliffhangers, and it's just like, it's really, really hard to get that much into. I mean, Linda, when you talked to the Russo brothers about Captain America Civil War, they said this movie could only exist in the Marvel Cinematic Universe because all of the character building has been done already.
Right.
And we just have to do something interesting with it. If we had to set up every single one of these characters, it would take 7 hours.
Of course. And I think that's absolutely true. Where do you come down on this, Chris? Where do you come down on villains?
Well, I agree that Heath Ledger's Joker is the most successful example in, you know, among modern superhero films. And I think the reason that filmmakers are reluctant to build out the villain's motives too specifically is because once you give the villain a plan that makes sense, they become the protagonist of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're the one who's trying to achieve something. The superhero is just reacting. They're just trying to preserve
and
the
is
status
in the way.
Quo. Yeah. And I mean, that's less interesting for an actor. That's less interesting for an audience. You know, it's less common for us to have the villain presented as the protagonist. I thought of Seven, the David Fincher movie, more of a horror movie, a police procedural, you know, slash horror than a superhero thing. But it becomes clear over the course of that film that Kevin Spacey, in the same year as The Usual Suspects, and if I remember, his name is not in the credits anywhere. Like, his appearance in that film was a surprise. It's his story. We come upon him very late after we've spent some time with these two cops. But, you know, I think that's the risk of giving
too much agency.
That's exactly the right word to what the villain is trying to do. Another example that Daoud cited in his Twitter conversation is John Huston's Noah Cross from Chinatown, one of the greatest villains.
Most chilling movie villain to me that I can think of.
Jess, can we play Noah Cross?
How much are you worth?
I have no idea. How much do you want?
No, I just want to know what you're worth. Over 10 million?
Oh, my, yes.
Why are you doing it? How much better can you eat? What can you buy that you can't already afford?
The future, Mr. Gitz. The future.
You know, what better definition of megalomania do you need? Like Lex Luthor, he's got this complicated scheme to inflate his property value, but he wants to control the future. He's an old man.
Yeah.
He wants to secure his legacy.
And this is where I would also throw in Alan Arkin in Wait Until Dark, which is a movie Stephen and I both really like. He plays a guy named Harry Rote, which I consider to be the best villain name ever because it's so... just sounds terrible. It sounds like he could only be a terrible person.
Harry Obligatory.
And he has a very complex plan, which has not only a large scale arc, but a lot of small pieces of how he intends to execute certain pieces of the plan. And we talked about how much we were going to get into this, but which is where he intersects with the great and good Hans Gruber from Die Hard, who I think is my favorite movie.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Now, we have talked about this. I can't remember where I have made this point, but I used to wonder a lot of times why there's a kind of gratuitously violent moment in Die Hard when mm-hmm. he kills an innocent person. And I used to sort of think, like, that's the only part of the movie that feels kind of, like, unnecessarily bloody and gross. Mm-hmm. And I used to kind of wonder why it was in there. And then I realized one time while I was watching the movie, it has to be in there because otherwise you would root for him.
Right.
Or at the very least, you would root for them to, like, team up at the end or something.
There is
some David Foster Wallace thing where he talks about rooting for Hans Gruber, like, without hesitation.
Well, and so people still do. Yeah. And there are people listening to this show right now who are like, no, I still root for him, right? And that's okay.
He does dress much better than John McClane.
But the best lever that they have to try to keep him on the villain side, since that's the role he plays in the movie, is to give him this one act that's very horrifying, because otherwise he has a really interesting, well-thought-out plan.
Yeah.
So, Stephen, where are you on all of this good guy, bad guy stuff in general?
All right. Well, Glenn Weldon is not here, and in the spirit of Glenn Weldon, I started trying to whip up a little bit of a taxonomy of movie villains, you know, about the motivations behind all of the various supervillains, and I was writing down things like greed/self-interest, which is kind of your Hans Gruber, your angry godman, you know, whatever. And I finally just decided to boil it down to a favorite and a least favorite.
Okay.
And I think for me, my favorite, the one that jumped out, speaking strictly of superhero villains in this case, is Dr. Octopus in the second Sam Raimi Spider-Man.
It's one of the best superhero movies ever.
Which is a great superhero movie, and it is also a wonderful example of the villain as the manifestation of curdled good intentions.
Like
somebody who originally had a plan to do good and just wound up getting all twisted up in the gears and winds up being this very, very sad character. And I think that character is so much more interesting than my least favorite kind of superhero villain, which is the video game final boss.
Yeah.
The all-powerful, undefeatable supervillain that you punch 7 octillion times, and then there's a moonshot that involves all 12 characters attacking at the same time, this one vulnerability. And like, that vulnerability is either explained to you, or it is occasionally, as in a certain movie we saw recently, just sort of explained as, character, do your thing.
Yeah.
That stuff is so uninteresting to me.
Yeah.
Like, I watch my kids play video games, and like, if you're playing a video game, it's fun to watch somebody go up against a final boss. In a movie, it can be very thudding. It can be very repetitious. It doesn't have the heft of a human gone sour.
Yeah.
So motivation-wise, I mean, I sort of see these things on a continuum. And if you can imagine like a straight line, and all the way on one end, you've got your Hans Gruber, your Kaiser Soze, Noah Cross, maybe Christoph Waltz's character in Inglourious Basterds.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the thing that's scary about those guys is that they have an almost eerie understanding of what they want and how to get it.
And they're rational.
And that's right. That's the thing they appeal to, or they sort of circumvent, is people's reason. All the way on the other side is maybe like horror movie villains. You've got like a Freddy or a Jason or like a Chucky. These are these sort of like supernatural, superpowered boogeymen.
Well, as you said, agents of chaos.
Right. Yeah. They are beyond reason. And that's the thing that's scary about them. There's no talking to them. There's no rationality. And supervillains, by and large, tend to land somewhere in the middle. And I think that's the thing. It's why their motivations tend to be sort of muddled, a little bit short-sighted. You end up with guys like, you know, Ronan the Accuser in Guardians of the Galaxy, which, like, I kind of like him as a villain just because he's so serious and he believes in himself so much. And you've got Chris Pratt opposite him, who is so goofy and so unself-serious, and it makes all of their interactions really funny.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite villain in this recent superhero universe that we're talking about is actually in X-Men 2. It's Brian Cox's version of Colonel William Stryker.
Yeah.
We can talk about the definition of super villain. He's a comic book villain. He doesn't have superpowers.
Yeah.
But he is the father of a mutant child in this version of the story. And the way that he tells it, the kid's powers kind of ruin his life. And he loses his wife because of them. And that's the source of his grudge with mutants and the X-Men. I mean, it's this deep personal hurt that he turns into this sort of pathological agenda. And he's not trying to destroy the world, quote unquote. I mean, he's trying, in his mind, to save it by getting rid of mutants. And that's, you know, with a plan that I guess you could compare to ethnic cleansing. But, you know, you can give that guy a small measure of empathy, mm-hmm. even though he's evil, because it's a relatable idea. Like, there's a reason why, like, the idea of your own spawn turning on you is so often explored in horror movies, because there's something I feel like probably a lot of parents like experience that a version of that thought at some point in their children's development.
Like Rosemary's Baby, or
that's right,
or even all the imagery of Alien and stuff,
Omen,
like really totally
the Omen stuff, yeah. and the Exorcist, yeah. and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, I think the other thing that I thought about when you were talking about the difference between kind of those boogeyman types and the kind of hyper rational types is that one of the things that makes it really difficult to create a compelling villain in a superhero movie is stakes, because those boogeymen kind of have no real plan except just to kill a bunch of people, and that's okay for that movie. But in a superhero movie, you're trying to create stakes, and I feel like it's not a coincidence that I go back to this like Lex Luthor plan of the 70s mm-hmm. that, you know, it was, like I said, a relatively compact idea inside that movie, mm-hmm. whereas now I think every movie has to come down to saving the world, saving the universe, saving all of all being. And it's really difficult to come up with a logical plan in which even a supervillain who has any kind of personality or anything would be trying to destroy the all planets. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Just to
be a jerk.
Well, it becomes a kind of mutually assured destruction thing, right? Almost where you think, like, well, where is he hoping to get to? Because he's got to know that if he does something this destructive, it's going to wind up destroying everything he has as well. So where is he trying to get to?
Supervillains with destroy the world plots ring kind of hollow right now because it's as though they've never seen a superhero movie.
Mm-hmm. No, that's true.
I mean, can we say that? Like,
yeah.
It's, you know, we're at a critical mass with these movies right now. I think Wes Craven, when he was on, I want to say it was Fresh Air, he talked about the beginning of the Scream franchise.
Yeah.
And his philosophy behind that series was like, we've come to a point with horror movies where it's as though nobody in any of these mm-hmm. movies has ever seen a horror movie before. Mm-hmm. And so they do silly things like running upstairs when they should run out the door. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a line in that movie. So it makes me wonder whether it's possible for, you know, going forward for these big budget comic book movies to take place in a world where big budget comic book movies exist.
That's a great point.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. It'd be interesting to have like a supervillain who's like, I've seen all the movies.
Right.
I know how this goes. Or like even a villain in a more earthbound movie who was kind of able to diagnose problems with plots.
Well,
I
think that kind of is the appeal of Deadpool, is that he breaks the fourth wall all the time and speaks directly to the reader.
Right.
This is another excellent argument for a Black Widow solo movie, though, because this is a character whose whole power is espionage and persuasion and doing things subtly. So this would probably not end with a giant explosion.
No, that's true.
I think it would be really cool.
Yeah, no, that's true. I think that's right. I wind up with this where I always wind up with this, which is I want every movie to be Die Hard. Well, once again, I will be curious to hear about all of your taxonomies and all of your ideas about supervillains and whether you agree with me about Die Hard, which, you know, if you don't, we can't be friends. That's not true. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, What is Making Us Happy This Week. So come right back.
Let's take a moment to thank and share a message from our sponsor, Airbnb. When you travel with Airbnb, you can live in over 2 million homes around the world. You don't have to experience a city like a tourist. Don't go to Paris to wait in lines. Don't go to LA to take a bus tour. And don't go to Tokyo to pose for the same photos. Paint the view from your host's garden. Wake up to the sunrise on a houseboat. Or have someone ask you for directions. Feel at home, explore your host's neighborhood, and truly experience a city. Live there, even if it's just for a night. Airbnb.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, first of all, I will start with what I think we're all thinking, which is that the first episode of NPR's new Code Switch podcast is really, really great.
Yes,
it is.
It's
as good as I'd hoped it would be.
It's very good.
Finally.
I barreled through the first, you know, the 38-minute first episode, and my immediate thought was like, it's kind of like a movie where it's like, I can't wait for all these other characters to get introduced. Yeah. Like, if you don't know all the characters on the Code Switch team,
there's
it's
so
just,
many other people.
There's
you
so
to
many
meet.
More people I like. So that's terrific. And obviously, we're all super proud that show
Find It Where You Find Podcasts
finally exists. Find It Where You Find Podcasts. And finally, the initials NSFW, Not Safe for Work, tend to apply to things that have nudity in them.
Mm-hmm.
Today, it applied to the Joe Posnanski essay called Hamilton, What's Better Than Seeing the Hottest Show on Broadway? Creating a Forever Memory.
Yes.
It first ran on Posnanski's personal blog, and the wise people at NBC Sports, where he works, were like, can we have that too?
Uh-huh.
And I blubbered. Just blubbered, at my, just blubbered at my desk. Like, I don't know if people noticed the sudden nose blowing.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, I've talked about him before.
The sports writer that we really, really like.
An amazing sports writer. And it's this story of how he just decided to just set aside a gigantic chunk of money mm-hmm. and go see Hamilton with his Hamilton-obsessed 14-year-old daughter.
Yeah.
And I have a Hamilton-obsessed 15-year-old son. I felt every word of this essay in my bones.
Yeah.
If you're interested in Hamilton, if you're interested in parenting, somehow if you're interested in the Cleveland Browns, it has all of
the
it.
The third corner of the triangle.
the third leg of the stool. It's so, so beautiful. He's such a wonderful writer. Hamilton, what's better than seeing the hottest show on Broadway, creating a forever memory.
It's wonderful. We will throw a link on the blog. And as always, you can find that at npr.org/monkeysee. All right. Chris Klimek, what is making you happy this week, sir?
I'm going to recommend two movies, one advisedly, one unequivocally. The advised one first. This is Yorgos Lanthimos' film, The Lobster. I brought a clip.
Oh, yeah.
Now, have you thought of what animal you'd like to be if you end up alone?
Yes, a lobster.
Why a lobster?
Because lobsters live for over 100 years, are blue-blooded like aristocrats, and stay fertile all their lives. I also like the sea, very much. I water ski and swim quite well since I was a teenager.
I must congratulate you. The first thing most people think of is a dog, which is why the world is full of dogs. Very few people choose an unusual animal, which is why they are endangered. A lobster is an excellent choice.
You could probably hear this is a more than surrealist tinged, more of a surrealism drenched mm-hmm. kind of dystopian future movie wherein coupledom is rigidly enforced. If you become single, you're given 45 days in a hotel to find a new mate. If you don't find one, you are transformed into an animal of your choosing. You know, if you are prepared for the existential interrogation of your relationship or past relationship or absence of a relationship will inspire, I encourage you to seek out this movie. Perplexing, very original.
Yeah, Bob Mondello is a fan of this movie, too.
Yeah, we talked about it. Also, The Nice Guys. It will probably not surprise you that I am a fan of Shane Black, writer of Lethal Weapon and The Last Boy Scout, writer-director
Story
of Iron Man
out.
3, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Yes, he has been making variations on this movie for his entire mm-hmm. career. This is at least the fourth movie, by my count, that he's made involving an alcoholic private detective, a widower. There's a precocious, wise beyond her years kid in this one. I think this is the best, funniest, warmest expression of this idea. It never teeters into being saccharine, but there is a warmth to it that is just low enough to feel sincere. Can we hear a bit of this, please, Jess?
You're the guy who beat up my dad.
Hey, no. Sucker punched your dad. Big difference. But don't worry. He just did it for money.
You beat people up. And charge money?
Yeah. Sad, isn't it?
That's really your job?
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah.
So, how much would you charge to beat up my friend Janet?
What?
How much you got?
$30.
Oh, $30.
Apple pie.
Is she a big girl?
She's tall.
All right.
Super but annoying.
Apple pie.
She's always mean to me.
$30. That's good. This conversation is over.
We're just talking.
So this is Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe. Ryan Gosling is the aforementioned alcoholic private detective slash widower. And Gori Rice is the name of the Australian actress with whom I was previously unfamiliar, who plays the Penny Gadget of this movie,
mm-hmm.
the girl who actually figures everything out and rescues her ne'er-do-well dad. She's also his designated driver in this movie, which I think is a pretty funny recurring joke.
Mm-hmm.
Russell Crowe is this professional leg breaker who sort of looks up to Ryan Gosling because he actually has a PI's license. But Russell Crowe is the more honorable of the pair, more honest with his clients,
okay. And
you know, within the world of criminals where you beat people up for
money.
Yeah,
I was gonna say, Chris, my conflict with this movie is
spectrum.
I love Ryan Gosling. I do not like Russell Crowe most of the time.
Well, he may surprise you. I have never seen Russell Crowe be funny.
I'm gonna see it.
With this. This movie is not doing super well. I think it's got about $25 million in the bank so far.
Oh, interesting.
And I just endorse it without hesitation. I think it is so much fun. It is so smart. The villain has a real logical scheme.
I'll take it.
Carefully worked out. Another feature of the Shane Black movie is the conspiracy usually makes sense, and it's just a ton of fun. So The Nice Guys is the film. Please go see it.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Chris Klimek. Dawood Tyler Amin, tell us what is making you happy this week.
So this is a little bit of a cheat because I've been a fan of it for a while, but it has been really, really good lately. It's a YouTube series called Every Frame a Painting, created by a guy named Tony Zhou, Z-H-O-U. 3 to 10 minute videos. And if I had to distill it to an essence, I guess I'd say that it's about how the technical aspects of filmmaking, so how the camera moves and the timing of edits, sound design, all of this stuff are just as much a part of the storytelling as more literal stuff like dialogue and costume and all of that. Just to give an idea of like what the tone is like, this is a little bit from maybe my favorite episode. It's called How to Do Action Comedy, and it focuses on the work of one Jackie Chan.
So, how does Jackie create action that is also funny? First off, he gives himself a disadvantage. No matter what film, Jackie always starts beneath his opponents. He has no shoes. He's handcuffed. He has a bomb in his mouth. From this point, he has to fight his way back to the top. Each action creates a logical reaction. And by following the logic, we get a joke.
So the best part of that episode is a little bit later where he talks about how fight scenes are edited. And he makes the point that in a lot of American action, the camera cuts on every single hit and your eye actually misses it as a result.
Mm-hmm.
It's a series organized around one person's taste. He has very strong opinions about what is good craft and what is lazy or uninspired or misguided. And so if you care about this stuff, like, you will disagree with him some of the time. But it is hard not to be impressed, at least entertained, by how methodical he is in breaking down what he thinks makes a technique work. So there's a great episode about Chuck Jones and his discipline and evolution in doing the Looney Tunes movies. There's a really good short one about just the scene in The Silence of the Lambs where Hannibal Lecter and Clarice Starling first meet and how the angle of the camera in each shot sort of telegraphs what each character wants at that moment. Mm. Really, really love it.
Sounds like just my cup of tea.
Yeah, awesome. I look forward to it every time. They come out maybe every month or two.
Mm-hmm.
So Every Frame a Painting. You can find it on YouTube and Vimeo and Tumblr and most places that you can find videos on the internet.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. I am not familiar with this. I will look it up.
You
Thank
would
you
love
very
it.
Much, sir. All right, I got two things this week. My first little one, spent some time over Memorial Day weekend marathoning episodes of The Prophet. Now, if you've never watched The Prophet, The Prophet is on CNBC, and it involves...
This is P-R-O-F-I-T.
F-I-T. It involves business consultant Marcus Lemonis, who goes and visits small businesses, and he invests in them, and then he tries to improve them. And weirdly, it is so much better than that makes it sound. It's actually a pretty good show. He goes to, like, I watched one where, like, he goes to a marshmallow factory and a little, like, artisanal marshmallow company where he tries to kind of get them in. He basically explains to them stuff like, there's a little graphic that explains how much a little popsicle stick costs and how much more you can sell a marshmallow pop than a regular marshmallow. He's like, stick a stick in your marshmallow and you can sell it for like 50 cents more and the stick costs 2 cents. So it's stuff like that. It's not monstrous. It's just money-making stuff, but brutal. I enjoy it very much. You start to learn what his rules are. Like, if you only make super high-end things for rich people, he will try to get you to make a line for regular people that's accessible to them. Anyway, it's super fun. The Prophet, CNBC. I was marathoning that. Anyway, so that's one. Two is Leslie Odom Jr., who Dawood spoke to on the podcast a while ago, was recently on Jimmy Fallon. And one of the stories that he told was about, he told a story about a night when he went to see Hamilton while he was off. So he had them get him tickets so he could be in the audience. And he told this whole story about how while he was sitting there, he realized that he was in, like, the fancy people section, logically enough. So there was a woman who I think was in front of him who was kind of turning around to scold a guy who was singing and humming and kind of talking during the show. And this, he describes this woman, and she keeps turning around. She keeps saying, please stop making noise. It's not that difficult. You don't talk during a show. And so gets to be intermission. And I think this is where Jessica can pick up the clip.
I elbow my wife and I said, it's going down. Like, I don't know who these people are, but it's going down. So that night, the woman gets up, she turns around, it's Shonda Rhimes. And the dude is Art Garfunkel. Shonda Rhimes.
What? They almost fought each other?
Shonda Rhimes almost whooped Art Garfunkel's ass.
Oh my God.
This is the kind of thing where a really good late night show for me is just an assemblage of little things like that. That's all I ever ask for. A few weeks ago, I played Stephen Colbert singing with Anna Kendrick. It's just these little things. That's all that a late night show really is. That's all it was when Johnny Carson did it. That's all it's been when anybody does it, except maybe David Letterman, who did more like weird Z's stuff. But much of late night is these little moments. And to me, a story, you think it's funny when he says the woman is Shonda Rhimes. You're like, oh, the woman's Shonda Rhimes. That's pretty badass. And then he says, the guy was Art Garfunkel. And it's, I could have given you 300 guesses about who the guy was. There's a 0% chance any of you would have said Art Garfunkel. So I love that story. He is so charming to listen to him kind of talk and tell stories and talk about his work. Again, obviously, if you have not listened to the interview that we ran on the show a few weeks ago, you should go listen to it. So that is what is making me happy this week. Business consultants and Broadway stars telling gossip stories on Art Garfunkel. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Steven at I Dislike Steven. You can follow Chris at CT Klimek. That's K-L-I-M-E-K. And you can follow Daoud Tyler Amin at Art Sorority. And you can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. And our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T. ZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks so much to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.